WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Michael Darce's new book, Paper Trail, is a collection of personal essays beginning with his own childhood. Darce was raised by a loving and colorful group of women. He's part Modoc Indian, has lived on a reservation, and has written extensively about the problems facing American Indians today. His book, The Broken Cord, about his adopted Indian son Abel, who had fetal alcohol syndrome, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Abel was killed a few years ago by a hit-and-run driver. Darce's two other adopted Indian children also have fetal alcohol syndrome. The Broken Cord focused attention on the debilitating effects of the syndrome. I asked Michael Darce if he had any hesitations about writing so publicly about private family matters.
The question of whether to write about fetal alcohol syndrome was something that evolved slowly over time. Initially, when I discovered what fetal alcohol syndrome was after basically 10 years of blaming everybody and everything that was curable, from teachers to our lack of early childhood experiences to our own bad parenting for our older son's problems, and finally came upon the scientific study of what FAS was, what happens to a child when the biological mother drinks too much during her pregnancy, I was going to write a kind of scientific article about it. And as I went around the country talking to parents and guardians of these kids, I realized that they were being very open with me and that it would be quite a skewed piece not to reveal that this was our story as well. And so Louise and I sat down with our son and we asked him how he felt about it. And we tried to give him as much informed consent as a person with his limitations could have. And we really, I think, kind of intuited from everything we knew about him, his generosity and his kindness, that if he could have thoroughly understood that by giving up some of the privacy, and we changed his name in the book, that he might prevent somebody else from having the same problems that he had, we were sure he would go with it. And so we made this decision as well. But it's not an easy decision. The Persia, our oldest child, came home from school the other day with a very troubling story. She said that one of the kids in her class had said, "I hear you have an older brother who has learning problems and who died." And it's a very painful subject, of course. And she said, "No, that's not true." And they said, "Oh, yes, it is. My mother read about it in a book." And so she was kind of horrified at having, she thought, done something terrible and denied Abel. And also embarrassed that she would have the burden of this story. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down with her, as we, I think, will with each of our young girls, and tried to explain our reasons for going public with it. And our hope that that by injecting it, not just through the book, but by the television film that was made into the kind of public discourse that, gee, I heard someplace it might be dangerous to drink while you're pregnant, let's skip this one, that it was Abel's contribution to make.
Did you ever read parts of the book to Abel to understand what you wrote about him and his condition?
Well, he didn't have a real long attention span, but he actually wrote the last chapter himself in his own words, and that made the book whole, I think. It didn't make a big impact on him when the book won a prize and was going to be made into a movie. He was quite removed from all of that. But quite affable about it all the same.
Tell us how Abel died, and he actually was working outside the home and had a job at a restaurant.
Yeah, he had a job as a dishwasher at a truck stop, and all of his life he had seizures, and in his early 20s, he had two brain surgeries that did this complicated operation that separates the hemispheres so that he would just have seizures on one side and not fall down. And it was actually going fairly well for him. It's a strange thing. He was in as good a situation as he could possibly be in. He was in a place that he liked. He was close by to us. He had a job he understood. And his seizures were less. And one dark night, he was crossing a street and was hit by a motorist who was not paying attention.
So it was the motorist's fault?
I'm sure it was. there was not an investigation, but, you know, when you have a disabled child, there are some things you teach them really well. And Abel was a tremendous street crosser. He would wait for a green light to turn red and then go green again before crossing because it was one of those things that we just pounded in over and over and over.
Did the motorist stop?
Not for a long time, actually. And we never heard from her. And, you know, she said that he had darted in front of the car. And because he was known by the police to have learning problems, they simply accepted her word for it, but we didn't.
How long did it take to find out who it was?
It took about 12 hours.
So she drove on?
She drove on, and then she stopped, and then she came back to inquire about it, and then she went on. You know, it was one of those things that I'm sure it was an accident, but and she was not a bad person, but I would imagine she would have felt better if she had ever made contact with us and achieved a kind of peace about it.
Well, I can't imagine as a parent anything more tragic than having a child die in
No.
before you do. I mean,
No.
it seems to almost break whatever that unwritten law is all about. I wonder with Abel and all the problems he had overcome whether you had ever prepared yourself for the fact that he might not live his full lifespan.
No, I absolutely had not. I think it's one of those unthinkable things that that we don't think. You know, when he had his brain surgeries, and I certainly worried about him a great deal, but he was healthy and strong physically in many respects, and certainly nothing life-threatening. So no, I don't. And he was such a vivid personality that that he inhabits our dreams often.
Mm.
And this kind of person he was, whenever we dream about him, he's happy.
Mm.
And it's always something that when we wake up, we feel good about that. And it's a blessing, actually. But it's the way he would have been.
He hung on for a couple of weeks after being
He never regained consciousness, yeah.
But you were with him?
Yeah.
You talked to him?
Sure.
What'd you say?
I apologized for all of my many failings. And I, for so many years, Abel was the kind of person that didn't really know what to say to abstract questions. And so for years, I would put words in his mouth when people would ask him an abstract question. I would say this and say that. And so I probably did the same thing in those conversations. But he was just a rather extraordinary person, which makes it appropriate that the contribution that he would have made, I think, in life had he not been inhibited by this terrible scourge over which he had no control. His mother drank antifreeze, actually, while she was pregnant, but it doesn't take that much. I mean, for some women, even a few drinks can be dangerous. But this is his contribution, this information to the world.
I'm speaking with Michael Darris. His new book is a collection of essays called Paper Trail. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with writer Michael Darris. Well, you write about Abel two things which I think really resonate with parents. Both, you said that you both underestimated and overestimated his abilities. I think parents do that no matter who or what their children are. And you also write that with Abel you believe that love and nurturance could make him right. Again, I think a very natural parental impulse. You have a whole bunch of kids. Did you feel that more intensely with Abel than with your other children?
I think you always feel more protective of the most disabled person, you know, because you don't want to see anybody hurt. All our other kids, our little girls in particular, experience the normal ups and downs. Persia came home from school the other day, and her best friend in life, had just turned into a snake, as 10-year-old girls sometimes do. And I just wanted to go and bawl out her parents for having such a terrible child who disappointed my daughter. But this is something that isn't the normal run of things. Abel never had a call. He never got a call from a friend. He never understood what chumming around would be, or what being curious in the library would be, or what watching a film all the way through And so you want to find something that makes him happy. And for years, I thought that what was my role is to include him in everything and always get him dressed up nicely and make him very polite and take him out whenever we went to dinner and all of this kind of stuff, and basically insisting that people accept him as he was. And it took me a very long time to realize that he didn't enjoy that one bit. He would much rather stay home in his room with a tape on and reading Garfield cartoons. And
you didn't want him to do that?
Well,
you wanted him to be in the world?
I wanted him to, talk politics. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted him to be all the things that I hadn't had the chance to be when I was growing up, as any parent does. But I think we all have to eventually accept our children as who they are. We should, at least. I think it's sometimes
hard.
A lifelong struggle. And enjoy them for that. Mm-hmm. And it when he finally got to be himself and was not being shoved into the mold that I insisted he be in, he became, I think, a happier person.
And that's the Abel you dream about?
Oh, you know, he had a real goofy smile. That's the Abel I dream about.
You have two other children also affected by fetal alcohol syndrome, although I get the feeling not quite as deeply as Abel was affected.
The thing about fetal alcohol syndrome is the best way to be affected, oddly enough, for most people is severely, because then society deems you disabled. If you have an IQ under 71, you qualify for certain services and assistance and educational benefits. And if you are within the normal range of IQ, but you have these problems with understanding right and wrong, with abstract thinking, with understanding consequences of an act, society labels you a sociopath or a thug or a bum and basically throws you away.
Is that what society's done with your two other kids?
They're both in prison.
They're both in prison?
Yeah.
For what?
For terrible crimes against mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. that come out of anger and frustration and simply the inability to be empathetic or empathic with the victims of their acts. It's a very common circumstance for fetal alcohol affected people. I've been asked to talk to groups of judges who see more and more people come before them in committing things called conscienceless crime, which make no sense, killing somebody over stealing a piece of gum and then going out and chewing the gum, not even running away. Mm-hmm. Or I was also asked to talk to a group of public defenders who deal with death row inmates who said that a disproportionate number of their clients were probably fetal alcohol affected. The man who kidnapped the little girl in Petaluma, California, is making a fetal alcohol defense, mm-hmm. saying that he didn't know any better because his mother drank during her pregnancy. And that may or may not be true. I think that there are a lot of crimes committed without understanding. And that doesn't automatically lead to a conclusion of what society should do about it except to prevent it from ever happening.
How then, I can see that this issue of fetal alcohol syndrome is still a very live issue for you, one that you still feel very passionate about. Have you resolved that question about how and when you intervene in a woman's life who is pregnant, who is drinking, and what responsibility you have to that child, you meaning society, and to that woman's right, of course, to make her own adult choices?
It's one of those terribly conflicting issues of conflicting rights. I think that there are several questions that have to be asked. Is this a pregnancy that is going to go forward? You know, I mean, is it going forward out of choice? If it is going forward out of choice, has the woman had access to good prenatal care? Is she capable of understanding the consequences? Because I think many mothers of FAS kids are themselves victims of FAS and consequently can't make a projection in the long term about what might happen if they do this today. If all those conditions are met and she can't understand, she herself is mentally impaired, then I think if the support network isn't there, if her partner or her parents or her sisters or brothers or children can't help her, and if she has already had an FAS child, I mean, I'm giving you basically the criterion
Absolutely.
That the Lakota tribe uses in intervening. And they are an independent sovereignty, and so they can make their own decisions about such things. But if a woman has had an FAS child, which means that her body does not process ethanol efficiently, The chances are, if she continues to drink, chances are like 95% that another child will also be impaired and even more severely. So if she has had an FAS child, she continues to drink, she can't be counseled out of it, there is no support network. At some point, the tribe insists that she be admitted to a detox center for a period of time.
They, in a sense, walk her to the the center.
Because there, in some communities in that particular place in South Dakota, it's estimated that a third of the children born are born impaired from alcohol use prenatally. And there's no money to care for them. Almost never does an FAS child stay with their biological parent. Very, very rarely. And not only that, it a woman who has given birth to fetal alcohol-affected children tends to not live very long herself because of the problems that that is symptomatic. And so, in a sense, you are it's a protective act of someone who can't understand. Now, that, I think, is a very small percentage. Mm-hmm. And most, maybe 7,500 people a year are born with full FAS. It's much more something like 80 or 90,000 a year who are born with fetal alcohol effect, which is a partial set of symptoms. And I think that is much more likely the case that a person who is simply not informed might continue to drink or doesn't have access to prenatal education and care. And those are things that society can certainly work on without any intrusion on rights, just making information available.
We'll talk more with writer Michael Doris in 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Michael Doris. His book, The Broken Cord, was about his adopted son, Abel, and Doris's own struggle to understand the debilitating effect fetal alcohol syndrome had on Abel. Doris's new book is a collection of essays called Paper Trail. The material I got about you describes you as Modoc and Irish and French. Which one do you identify with most?
I think all. Irish and French are pretty far back, and I think that's just American, just sort of general American. Yeah. But I did grow up partly on reservation and partly in not on reservation. And on the one hand, it makes for a kind of schizophrenic background, being mixed blood. But on the other hand, it's great to be for a writer, because as a person who lives a little bit on the outside of things, you have to observe very closely to see how people on the inside operate. You always kind of want to be one thing or the other very clearly. But for an anthropologist, mm-hmm. which I was for a long time, or for mm-hmm. a writer, it's a skill and that is important to develop.
Let me pick up on something you said earlier about being an outsider, and certainly many writers talk about that being on the outside, of course, has some lonely attributes, but it also gives you a kind of perspective that insiders don't have. And this is reading from one of your essays. Unpopular is too kind a word to describe my status, and this is when you were a little boy. I was the kind of kid who wore glasses from the second grade on and never took them off, the kind who got his homework in on the day it was due, sometimes typed, the kind who could not catch a ball even when it fell into his baseball glove. Everyone I knew seemed to be part of groups whose doors were closed to me, so I had plenty of time to daydream, to imagine traveling to far-off places, meeting interesting exotic people, being appreciated for the fascinating individual I was sure I was. Do you still feel like an outsider now? You've had a fair amount of acclaim. People read you all over the place, from Glamour to the New York Times to Mother Jones. You're more of an insider now, aren't you?
Oh, I can't complain. I really can't complain. I am so fortunate in the hand of cards that life has dealt me. But I think along that line, you look around at the interesting people that one knows in life, and didn't they all have miserable childhoods
Absolutely.
Or adolescences or something? I mean, all those people who we admired so much and wished we were when we were in high school, I don't know what they're doing today, but I don't find them among my circle of friends so much. Somebody said, hi, I'm the president of the student council. You know, I'm sure they're all just great. But probably, and undoubtedly it's true, their lives were complicated by success in ways that we, looking enviously at them, didn't quite recognize.
And do you get manuscripts on time into your publisher? And have you continued?
Typed.
Typed,
yes.
And
typed,
everything.
Still typed.
But you're saying that that the condition of your childhood made you a writer?
I think the condition of my childhood made me reflective, made me thoughtful. I had time on my hands to think about what was important to me, because I was certainly not sought after. And I look upon that, and I try and tell my children when they're feeling slighted by their friends that this is a time to take advantage of, rather than to simply brood about. That's a hard sell, actually, when you're a kid. But I think one looks back at those times and you remember the moments of self-discovery and reading a book that you just were stunned by. And there are the formative moments.
Well, Michael Doris, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Doris's new book is called Paper Trail.